Welcome to the Cop Doc Podcast. This podcast explores police leadership issues and innovative ideas. The Cop Doc shares thoughts and ideas as he talks with leaders in policing, communities, academia, and other government agencies. And now, please join Dr. Steve Morreale and industry thought leaders as they share their insights and experience on the Cop Doc Podcast.
Well, here we are again. Hello, everybody. Steve Morreale from Boston, and this is the Cop Doc Podcast. We have a bi-coastal discussion going on. I have the pleasure, the honor, to talk with Barney Malekian, who is a person who has been in a life of public service. Barney, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining. So now you're at Santa Barbara. You have made the rounds. I did a little bit of research on what you did. Military, Army, Coast Guard. You were serving in police departments in California. I see. Correct me when I'm missing. Santa Monica, chief in Pasadena for many years. Santa Barbara County Sheriff's as the undersheriff. And now the interim at a beautiful city, Santa Barbara. What the hell is wrong with you? So you've been an interim here and there. It's funny. It seems like you come and you go, you leave and you get itchy and you think, I think I want to go back. What's going on?
No, you know, actually, I was with Santa Monica Police Department where I started my career. I was there for 23 years. And I was the police chief for 13 years in Pasadena. Mm-hmm. And then I had the privilege of going to DOJ and being the cops office director for almost 4 years. And my wife and I thought I was going to retire, but I didn't do a very good job of that. We came to Santa Barbara. We always wanted to be here, loved the place. Mm-hmm. And I got a call from the sheriff one day asking if I would consider being his undersheriff. He was going through some personnel issues and wanted to do some leadership development. And I thought about it and I said, I would be honored. And I did that for almost 4 years. And then I had a pretty significant knee injury. And so I stepped down from there. And it was time anyway. I'm well aware of the year. I pull out my driver's license periodically and look at the year of my birth. Do a reality check. But then the county CEO said, well, come oversee public safety projects. And so I had every intention of retiring this June. Mm-hmm. When Chief Lori Lenau announced that she was back in December that she was going to retire. And I agreed to serve as the interim until we pick a new permanent police chief. Mm-hmm. I'm honored to do the work. I would probably not agree to serve as an interim chief anywhere except the city that I live in.
Yes.
I will be here after I'm done with this. But I'm just honored. I never thought I would be sort of active in the field this long, but I feel very privileged to be doing it.
Well, my guess is, and you know, I've had a very long career myself, not as long as you. I think what draws us is the desire to serve, but you must love cops.
I absolutely do. And I was one of the hardest things for me last summer when I was sitting over in the county office, non-operational, non-sworn job, was watching the discussion about policing in America somehow morph to an attack on individual officers in a way that I've never seen in my almost 50 years of doing this. And it just drove me crazy to not be able to do something. Because I think this we can talk about changing systems, and we can talk about, you know, what should police respond to, all those things. But as you know, our profession is populated by extraordinarily good people, and they're being tarnished by the actions of a reprehensible few.
It's interesting to watch you from afar and to see you have the passion that you have and the willingness at the craziest time in policing to come back and help to lead and guide a police agency is inspirational unto itself. I applaud you. I have to say that. You, crazy guy that you are, went back to school and you sought your doctorate. Talk about that. What the hell were you thinking?
Apparently not. No, I've done my entire academic education has been done on the installment plan. You know, I took 10 years to get a bachelor's degree. I took 8 years to get a master's, or 10 years to get a master's. My original motivation was pretty straightforward. It occurred to me that there were a lot of, at some point I knew I was going to hire. I didn't think I would be going on this long either. And I said, you know, there's a lot of retired police chiefs out there, but there's not that many with doctorates. I should probably pursue that. Plus, school has always been kind of a hobby for me. Mm-hmm. And so I applied for the program, and they allow you, the University of Southern California allows you 8 years late to program, and I used every minute of it. So I have been doing the installment plan all along, but I did my dissertation on values-based discipline on police disciplinary systems, and I think that's turned out to be pretty timely work.
It's interesting because I think when I met you in our conversation, you started to leak out that you were going to school, and at that point in time, I think I was either leaving DEA or I was just started as an academic. And so it was interesting to watch what you were doing and understanding the difficulty, but the hard work of doing a dissertation and doing it in a discipline that you know is rewarding unto itself. So congratulations on that, not only Chief, but Dr. Malekian. Let's talk about a few things if I can. You've walked in and out of police agencies. You walked into the DOJ with the cops office. And obviously when you walk in, you take a look, you do a pulse check. I'm sure you do some listening and some learning about the organization and still instead of coming in and dictating your mandates. What are the things that you look at when you assess a police department? And by the way, I know that you've walked in and done police management studies. What are the things that you look at? What are the things that you want to know before in order to make some decisions and make some refinements?
You know, I think two of the things, I mean, there's a whole laundry list of sort of bullet points. I think two of the biggest things, particularly among the leadership ranks, is there a discussion and an awareness of vision in the future. Somebody asked Wayne Gretzky, why are you such a great hockey player? And he said, because I skate to where the puck is going. And I look to see, are the discussions in the leadership group, are they tactical and are they here and now? Or is there a reflection that we know we're going someplace else? Secondly, is in talking to the rank and file. And I try not to talk at them too much. Try to tell them who I am and sort of what I'm about. See what there are. And the question is, and what I look for is, are there questions that they ask? Are they reflective of wanting to make the organization better? Are they reflective of wanting things to be better for them? Uh-huh. And that's a sometimes a subtle distinction, but it tells me where the organization is at any given time.
I'm stopping because I was just looking down, but it seems to me, I talked to a chief, a Minneapolis chief, the last couple of days, and one of the things that struck me was that who he was trying to hire and his group, he was pushing his group towards hiring people with a service orientation and was talking about customer service, which unto itself is foreign in a lot of ways, except I don't think it is because we are a service organization. But I really like what you just said, listening to what is being said and then analyzing what's being said. Are you here for you? Or are you here to make the town, the city, county better? In other words, and I often talk this way about it with faculty members. And well, wait a minute, is what I'm hearing what you need or what the students need? What's the focus? Because aren't we here for the students? You're shaking your head. Nobody else can see you, but I can. So what's your reaction to that?
No, I think it's absolutely critical. I'm thinking about Lao Tzu and the Tao Te Ching, who says, you know, when the master teaches, the student says we did it ourselves. Probably one of the things I'm proudest of when I was at Pasadena PD Police Department was the No More Dead Children program, which was a homicide reduction effort, which was very successful. And it was modeled on the Boston Police Department and the work that they did with the 10-point plan.
Yes.
But at the end of the day, that program was, and there were people when I said our number one strategic goal is no more dead children on the streets of Pasadena, because we had a ridiculous homicide rate for a city of 140,000 people. And a lot of victims had been kids. There were people who told me I shouldn't have said that because it couldn't be done. But I said, well, it can be done. But the truth of the matter is it's done by the work of the men and women who drive the radio cars, who investigate the cases, who dispatch calls, who answer phones, who do the outreach. They do the real work. Mm-hmm. And I've said it in a couple of different organizations, and sometimes people don't like it. I say, you know, I don't do it. I'll say it to the command staff. I said, we don't do real work. Real work is done by these people out here. We make it possible. We say, this is the direction we'd like you to go, and we make it possible. Mm-hmm. I'll close with this. One of my heroes in life is Dr. Stephen Sample, who was president of USC, and who wrote the book, The Contrarian's Guide to Leadership. And in that book, he was talking about being university president, but it applies to a lot of things. He said, many people want to be president. He said, but very few people want to do president. I think to that end, I think this notion of, are you serving something greater than yourself? That's why we all got in this business in the first place, was we wanted, I mean, whether it was a spirit of adventure or a spirit of service or whatever it was, we wanted to serve something bigger than ourselves. And if we're not careful, and as leaders, if we're not careful, people can forget that because it gets lost in the day to day, but we get to remind them of it.
Well, that's interesting. Yesterday, I did a training. I hate to use it a training, but I facilitated a discussion with the police department in my hometown. And one of the questions I asked, why did you become a police officer in the first place? And where did you lose your way? And what's really important? What about people? How many of you have made a friend for the agency? And you know what? COVID be damned. That excuse, it was a struggle getting through COVID. There's no question about that. And we're still clinging to sort of the vestiges of COVID, but we're coming out of it. And I think part of what you would be talking to Santa Barbara, okay, that's over. Let's get back to business. And Barney, one of the things that I said, and to hear your perspective, I want to talk a little bit about leadership development, but it seems to me the sergeant on the street and those officers are the people who get the work done. Exactly what you said a moment ago. But what strikes me too, and when I say it, many people don't realize it. When you and I raised our hand the first time and swore an oath to become an officer, I'd say 90 to 95% of the people who did that with us are going to start as officers and end as officers. That not many of them move on to take on the responsibility of other people. So how do we keep them motivated when they're doing the same job for 20 or 30 years? What do you think?
That's interesting you brought that up. A few times in my career, I've been rendered speechless. And one of them was I came back from sergeant school as a brand new sergeant, and I was very pumped up with all the stuff that I'd learned. And I'm talking to this officer who's been on the graveyard shift for 30 years. And you've met him. We've met him 100 times.
They're everywhere. Yes.
And I'm giving him this whole speech about mentoring young troops and informal leadership and all this stuff. And he finally looks at me and he says, Sarge, he says, you know, I really like you. He said, but do you know what my operating philosophy is? And I said, no, I can't say that I do. And he said, if the minimum wasn't good enough, it wouldn't be the minimum. And I really didn't know how to respond to it. But in thinking about it later, I realized it's true. That's the bottom line of civil service protection, whether you're in policing or not, is that that statement is true. And so then our responsibility as leaders, I think, is to help people raise their own bar about what constitutes the minimum, because otherwise they can simply go and hide out. Mm-hmm. Secondly, and I don't think it's as true today, but certainly when I came, and I suspect when you came in, the people who had been promoted ahead of us did so with the almost usually unspoken belief that they had been promoted because they were better at doing job than their peers were. And in some cases, that may be true, but in some other cases, it may be that they're just better at taking tests or better at being interviewed. But regardless, I think today we've sort of moved to a direction of servant leadership, all of that kind of thing. And I'm glad to see it. I think for a long time, we looked at that 30-year graveyard patrolman as if he was less because he or she had chosen simply to be an officer. I do think that one of the challenges that we're facing right now in the profession is because of schedules and because of different changing sort of family orientations and family value expectations about work-life balance and things. I'm seeing a lot of people who don't take promotional tests for very pragmatic personal reasons. They get into a schedule that they like, they get into a job that they like, it's comfortable, it works for them and their family, and they don't promote. And I think we're going to have to figure out how to deal with that.
There's so many things that I'd love to chat with you about. And time is all we have and have control over. But January 6th, what were your feelings when you saw what you saw on television? How did it change America?
I'm not embarrassed to say that I stood in my living room and watched that and cried. I could cry today thinking about it. I thought it was an assault on American democracy. It was a reflection of frustration. It was a reflection of the cultural and political divide that exists in this country. And if we're honest about it, the institutions of this country have been under attack now for several years. Regardless of what you think about a particular president, and over the course of 200 plus years, we've had several that not great at best, but it somehow became fashionable to attack the president of the United States. It became fashionable to crucify candidates to the U.S. Supreme Court. It became fashionable to burn the flag. All those things said that, and to me, January 6th was just a culmination of that. And it's not about which side of the political spectrum you're on, but that building stands as a symbol of the United States and of the greatest democracy the world has ever seen. I'm sorry to be given a sermon, but it just stunned me. And what stuns me almost as much is the attempt over the last few months as I listened to different news broadcasts to paint that as something other than what it was.
Yeah, and I suppose those part of you wants to go and help. The other part says, what would I do if I was in that situation, if I was running it? And so I'm glad that it has settled down. I think the response was way too slow for the officers that were calling for help, and that's unfortunate. And I know that as a leader yourself, you would say, okay, well, what can we learn from that? If this, you know, if the proverbial shit hits the fan, how are we going to react? Are we going to send people for help once the call for help comes out? But let's talk about leadership, your rise in leadership, your view of leadership, but more importantly, not yours. How do you drive that through the organization? You walk into an organization and really, again, I think we could use the same premise, and that is it's not about you anymore, Barney. It's about the people, and it's about getting them ready to sustain the organization, no matter the organization. Now, how do you do that as you're sitting in meetings? You know, you walk into the Santa Barbara Police Department. You knew the chief. You were working as a county law enforcement officer, but did you know all of the people?
No.
Okay.
I did not.
So you had to get to know them. Talk about that. How'd you do that? What was your approach, if you don't mind?
One of the things that I did, and fortunately, you know, the Santa Barbara Police Department isn't that large, so I was able to do this, but there was about a two-month window between when it was announced that I was going to do this job and when I actually was going to start. And so one of the things I did was I reached out to every lieutenant and civilian manager in the department and the captains and basically had them to my house for a one-on-one meeting. When I'm not that person, you know, I have no official responsibility, just to get to know them and the issues and their take on. Secondly, is when I came into the building, I made it very clear from the minute one that I think the common vision of an interim chief is that, well, they sit back and sign the things they need to sign and go talk to the city council.
Yeah, you're babysitting, right? Yeah.
And I made it very clear I had no intention of doing that. As it has turned out, I haven't had that luxury anyway. It's never been an option for a variety of reasons.
Right.
But I think the biggest thing is to continually ask people their opinions. I know a great deal about policing. I know far less about the nuances of the Santa Barbara Police Department. And if I don't listen to them and get their opinions and see how they answer the question, why do we do this? Or why do you recommend it? And I think what it's done, at least I hope what it's done, is to promote a recognition that this person, me, is here. Mm-hmm. And if we help him, we are helping the organization. We are helping set up the organization for long-term success. Mm-hmm. And we're helping ourselves at the same time. So I'm not sure if I answered your question.
You did. And one of the things you did, and if you see the book I'm holding up, Leading with Questions, right? I mean, I think that's exactly, this is one of my favorite books. It's called Leading with Questions, Mike Marquardt. But very often, it's something I'm sure that you do regularly, Barney, and that is to ask questions. Why? What? How come? Have we thought about a different way? Is there another opportunity? Who's missing at the table? It's those kinds of questions that I'm sure you have asked. You know, however it came into your MO, I mean, I think that's important. I've asked questions. I remember talking to your colleague, Jim McDonald, and many others when I did some decision-making questions with some major city chiefs. And I asked, how do you make decisions? How did you learn to lead? Where did it come from? And let's talk about that. Let's talk about your personal development from the military into policing, and then how that carries into, you know, how you're suggesting that other people develop their leadership mindset.
Good question. I think when I look back on how that happened, I think there was a transformation in place when I was around 40. People have asked me, did I have a plan? You know, did I have some sort of career plan? I never had a plan. You know, it just kind of was, oh, that looks like a good thing to do. I'll do that. But, you know, I served 3 years in the Army, and I was glad.
Me too. Good one. Thank you for your service. I salute you, sir.
And then I was working in a bank, and I didn't particularly like that.
Can I interrupt you, Barney? My first job was as a bank teller. And when I realized what little they were paying me and how much some big shots were getting paid, I thought, I can't do this anymore. It might be the same thing.
Yeah. Well, maybe so, because, you know, I then saw, you know, I saw basically an ad for law enforcement, and I thought was, well, I'll be a lawyer, but I'll do this for 2 or 3 years and then I'll go to law school. I didn't count on falling in love with the profession, because I absolutely did. And about 10 years later, I did apply to law school and got accepted. And I fortunately talked to a fairly big time lawyer in LA about it. And he talked to me for a while. He said, you really love what you do, don't you? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, you should ask yourself if you think you're going to practice love. practicing the law as much. And I thought about it and decided not to go to law school, which I've never regretted. I essentially enjoyed street cop work. I enjoyed being a police officer. I never really thought about the future, or even really in retrospect, I did recognize, although I didn't recognize that I recognized, that one of the great things about this job is that you make a difference in the lives of everybody you come in contact with. And if you promote within the organization and you're a sergeant or a lieutenant, you can make a difference in the lives of work for you. Mm-hmm. I didn't fully appreciate that, but in looking back, I was doing some of that. But I think the defining moment for me was, I always said, I think I was an excellent sergeant, and I think I was a terrible lieutenant for a whole bunch of reasons, which we can go into if you want. But fortunately, I hadn't been a lieutenant very long when I had joined the U.S. Coast Guard Reserve, who allowed me to drive their boat and spend one weekend a month on the ocean off Southern California and work with a great bunch of people. And I was really enjoying that. And in truth, it was kind of like a hobby until December of 1991, when they said, guess what? We're going to send you to Saudi Arabia. And there's only 300 Coast Guard people going to Saudi Arabia, and you're going to be one of them. And,
wow.
So off I went. And suddenly I went from being a lieutenant of police, where people at least tended to care what my opinion was, to at that time an E5 in a combat zone where nobody really cared what my opinion was. And that was a very transformative period for me, because I think that up until that point, in terms of leadership, I had been sort of mimicking things I'd seen. But when I was in Saudi Arabia, I think I and a few other people, most of whom were police officers, which was not an exception, whose rank was not particularly high, but we became the informal leaders in a lot of ways. And it really struck me that rank had less to do with leadership than what you were bringing to the game. And rank just helped you do that. And I came back, I know that I came back from Saudi Arabia a very different person than I was when I left, and a very different leader than when I left. And I think I was a lot more serious about what I was trying to do at that point.
Well, what you're saying is what we've heard over and over again is leadership is a process, not a position. It's not the stripes on your sleeve. It's not the bars on your lapel, but it is the process. And let's talk about that for a moment. I just wrote, what are the elements? And that, what is the process of leading? So when you walk into this new organization, you've got tremendous experience in all kinds of ways, and people are looking to you. You've got silver hair, which distinguishes you, but it's the background that you have. What are the conversations you're having with command staff to help them through this crisis period of time we're going through, where police are disdained, they're blasphemed, and yet focus on the job that we have to do no matter what they're saying about us? In other words, how do we police through the noise?
Couple things about that. One is that I think that we have to acknowledge that the things that certain elements in the public are angry about are legitimate. That they're not born, that people didn't make them up. It's not part of some grand conspiracy. The issues of historic quality or prejudice. When I came to Pasadena, everybody thinks Pasadena is 2 square miles of mansions, and once a year it has a parade.
Yes.
The reality is that it's the fourth biggest city in LA County. It's a majority-minority city, and it's home to the oldest Black community in Southern California. And racial politics were alive and well. There are people in Pasadena who remember when they could not swim in the municipal pool.
Oh.
There are people who remember when they could not walk east of Fair Oaks Avenue after dark. And those, you'll never find those rules written down anywhere. You won't find them in a municipal code or council resolution. But if we're honest, we know that the police were involved in making sure that those things were enforced. Now, we have spent, people in my generation, your generation, we've spent 40, 50 years trying to overcome that. But the anger is coming from a legitimate place. Secondly, in terms of reminding command staff and everybody else what our mission is, it is to remind people of what we do. I think you're seeing examples all over the United States of places that have tried to defund the police or do some, you know, limit what they can do. And they're paying a price for it, because 99.9% of the officers in this country go to work every day. There's a great book that just came out. You may have read it, called Tangled Up in Blue by Rosa Brooks.
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
I think it's extraordinary. I think the point that she makes, and I'll try to condense it in the interest of time, the officers, for the most part, deal with the things that are put in front of them. And the way that those things are put in front of them is somebody calls the police and says, I need help. And a dispatcher sends a police officer to try to solve that problem. That's in a very oversimplified term, that's the way it is. The officers are not making racially based decisions. for the most part. There may be some, but they're not making racially based decisions. But what the officers have to, I think, be more aware of, and probably aren't, is that very often, for example, particularly high crime or high poverty neighborhoods, especially if they're minority neighborhoods, those neighborhoods came into existence. When people talk about systemic racism or historic racism, those neighborhoods exist for a reason. They were created. And so the officers aren't part of the solution. They didn't cause the problem, but they're tasked with being part of the solution. And so besides asking the questions to the new command staff and the new officers, I try to continually drive home this message about why is the environment that we're in, why does it look like this? And tactically speaking, how do you take some steps to remind locally elected officials that when we get done having this 20,000 foot conversation about policing in America, let's have a 500-foot conversation about policing in this town, this place, this time.
Localize it. What does it mean here? What do we want here? Well, that's interesting, too, because as a police chief, I'm sure we should not be telling our customers how they will be policed, but asking them what they need. And in a lot of ways, I think you do the same thing internally. What do you need to do the job? And what do you want from us? You're shaking your head. So obviously that's resonating with you. What comes to mind?
I think there's no question that in COVID, you're absolutely right. It's come out of COVID, we can sort of get back to normal, but it does present an opportunity to decide what going back to normal actually looks like. And this is going to be a little bit controversial, I think, but I have begun over the last decade or so to really question the manner in which random patrol is carried out. I think it produces unspoken pressure on individual officers to do something. They get measured by how many people did you stop? How many tickets did you write? How many field interview cards fill out? There's this pressure to deliver something measurable. And I would argue that patrol needs to move to Herman Goldstein's problem-oriented focus, that they deal with specific and real neighborhood problems, and that the metrics that by which we measure patrol officers change to things like number of non-enforcement contact, minutes or hours spent on neighborhood footbeat or park checks, or those. It'll vary from place to place. But I think we have to change the nature of random patrol, because when I was at the cop's office, everybody knew that the definition of community policing was build relationships and solve problems. But what everybody forgot, there was actually a third part, but we always whispered the third one. It was build relationships, solve problems, and transform the police department. And transform the police department.
I heard you. Because
we didn't like to talk about that part, but it does. Because if you can create an environment where the individual officers are building relationship people and actually get to do something constructive that they see the results. Michael Nela from the Blue Courage Foundation, who's one of my heroes in this business, says, the greatest danger, corruption in the 21st century is cynicism. Joseph Wamba in his book, The New Centurions, 50, 60 years ago.
I remember reading that a long time ago, yes.
The greatest danger to police officers was not a criminal's bullet or a speeding car. He said it was a daily drop of corrosion on the human soul.
Yeah.
We all talk about the fact that officers see the worst in humanity, but part of it is that we set that up. And if we can shift that patrol focus to problem solving, where the officers are directly involved in making things better, I think we create that sense of purpose.
Well, again, yesterday, thank you for saying that, because yesterday I talked about how do you document going and shaking hands and talking and being available and stopping and showing up on the sidelines of a youth soccer game or a youth baseball game and humanize the person in uniform? But how do you capture that? And we don't measure. We measure output, not outcomes. And you know very well, you started to talk about the importance of measuring outcomes, which is another way of saying solve the problems, identify the problems, and then work to solve them.
Yeah, and I think it's in the UK. I was one of my consulting projects when I was doing that was with the LA Sheriff's Transit Police. And I was contrasting how American policing polices transit versus how it's done in the UK. In the UK, they have this concept of felt presence. And the most simplistic example is that in America, officers will walk into a train car, two of them together, and they will walk through the car and out. In the UK, the officers will enter the train car from either end by themselves. They may or may not walk through the car, or they may simply be there, look around, see what's going on, and step off the car. And the term that they use, and I really like it, is felt presence. People know that they're there, but it isn't particularly intrusive. They're just there, and it's comforting. And then they leave. I get asked a lot, as you know, there's a lot of jokes about the difference between law enforcement, fire service. And, everybody loves the fire service. Nobody loves the cops, and the great mystery is why. I think I have the answer. People love the fire department for two reasons. One is the fire department only involves themselves in your life when you ask them to. They only come when they're called. And secondly, the things that they come for, the things that they involve themselves in your life with, are things that you generally agree are a problem. If your house is on fire, you agree that's a problem. If you're having a heart attack, you agree that's a problem. If somebody dumps hazardous material in the street in front of your house, you'll agree that's a problem. There's no dispute about it. But in policing, what we do, and some of it can't be avoided, is we very often involve ourselves in your life, whether you wanted us to or not. Your neighbor called you. Either we saw you doing something, or your neighbor saw you doing something, called, and so out we come and involve yourself. And it may or may not be important to your neighbor, but it may or certainly may not be important to the person talking to you. The whole difference in philosophy. But that whole felt presence piece, that whole notion of how we do this work, I think deserves more study.
I think another word that we use a lot, I don't think it's certainly not the same, but visibility. We don't want somebody to sit out. You don't have snowstorms where you are, but when there'd be a snowstorm here, you say, park your vehicle in a place where people can see you and don't go anywhere unless there's something to go to. You just said something. What I think police get sucked into, police officers and calls, is one of the things that comes to my attention, and probably yours too, is racism by proxy, where somebody says, hey, I see a black man outside my house and they don't look like they belong there. And then the poor police have to show up and they're just responding to a call. And so that's a problem. And for police to understand that they can be sucked into this racial issue so that they don't, and they handle it the right way. I think what I want to ask you, Barney, about that and others is, where are the teachable moments? And how do we use teachable moments like that so that we don't repeat the same mistakes over and over again?
That's a perfect example of the conundrum that gets created. Because Citizen A calls and says, there's this person, and there's a black person on my street or in front of my house, they don't belong. And I think, first of all, one thing is, I think that one area of the criminal justice system that is incredibly overlooked and neglected is communications and dispatch. At least every place I've ever worked, the ratio is generally 7-1 in terms of the number of times that dispatch will answer the phone versus the number of times that an officer will actually get dispatched. We don't, and much like police officers, our dispatchers are extraordinarily good at handling life-threatening crises, the 911 emergency, but maybe less so about dealing with some of the things. And to use this example, the question would be, what is the person doing? We have to develop a script that dispatch asks, what is this person doing? Why are they suspicious? And you and I both know that most people don't want to say, well, they're just black and we don't have any black people living on the street.
Horrible.
They don't want to say that.
Yeah.
But that's really what their concern is. Mm-hmm. So you pin them down a little bit on that. And then secondly, when you dispatch the call, generally that call that you described will go out as a suspicious person or something similar. That keys that up in the officer's mind. I was on the National Task Force back about 20 years ago on mental health and criminal justice. And one of the things that they talked about was the role that dispatch played in amping up a patrol officer's anxiety by the way they dispatch call, by the way they describe with the person's actions and that. And there was a whole emphasis on calming that down. Well, you could do the same thing here. You could say quite directly, person is calling about a person on the street, and maybe we make a decision that we're going to drive down that street, but we're not going to stop that person. Or if we are going to stop that person, we make it an introduction as opposed, I'm just talking off the top of my head, because I understand the dilemma that the patrol officer's in. And I don't know that I know what the answer is, but it doesn't have to be as direct as person A calls, person doesn't belong here. That gets dispatched as a suspicious person with virtually no other information, whether and the officer is then left to be the one to sort it out. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that a lot of that sorting can take place on the
beforehand and may not yield call out. Well, you're right. I think part of the things we begin to think about or talk about with new officers or other officers is you have the authority. Do you always have to use that authority? Can it be curiosity? Can it be a bit friendlier? Can it be those kinds of things? As simplify as I said it before, when's the last time you may have had these conversations with your people? When's the last time you made a friend for the police department? We don't need any more enemy. And I think that's a pretty important thing. Let me ask you this. In terms of this interview, your perspective of what we've been able to talk about and how important these things are for people who are both inside and outside to understand the mindset that you bring to the job and how you try to guide the thoughts and the practices of people who are in this job.
You know, I've said for a long time, I'll give you the history of it, that the truth or falsity of the Constitution and all the things that we talk about and all the values we say that we hold, for many people in many neighborhoods, the truth or falsity of those values are confirmed or denied by the individual police officer on the street. Their actions are so incredibly important. Some years ago, I actually invited Eldridge Cleaver to speak to the Pasadena Police Department. When I was a very young cop, Eldridge Cleaver was on the FBI's most wanted list. I was looking for Eldridge Cleaver on the beaches of Santa Monica. I did not realize that he had gone to Cuba already and he wasn't there for me to find him.
Well, why didn't you find Whitey Bulger for us? I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry. I had to say that.
I don't know. And he was probably there too when I was there and I missed him.
All right.
So, you know, I meet with Eldridge Cleaver and I have breakfast with him before he's going to go speak to the cops. And I said, boy, you've come a long way since you hated the cops in Oakland. And he said, Chief, he said, we didn't hate the cops in Oakland. He said, we hated the government. He said, the cops were just the only arm of government we ever saw.
Yeah.
And that's where that really impacted me. Because he said, you know, 10% of those cops were the most outstanding human beings I've ever met. He said, and 10% of them were something else. Uh-huh. He said, and the 80% of them were in the middle, good people, trying to do their job, kind of what you and I would say about any organization that we were in. But that whole notion, this whole issue about what is the role of the police and how do we, you know, there's all this talk about building public trust. If we had another hour, I'd talk about that. But I do think that building public trust is built one relationship at a time. It's built one action at a time. And when there are bad things that happen, and they will, then leadership has to step up and do two things. It has to make it very clear to the public what happened. So, for example, in California, you have up to 60 days to release body cam video. You can hold it back under certain circumstances. Except for some extraordinary circumstances, my intention to always release video within 72 to 96 hours because the public needs to know what happened.
Well, and the fear is, and the inclination is, you're hiding something.
Right. Funny, I found a 1922 document. Somebody gave me a book that somebody wrote about the history of the Santa Barbara Police Department. And in there was a kind of a journal entry from a rookie patrolman in 1922. And in there, he said that his training officer told him to try to avoid using his weapon because the public did not like the police killing people. I don't think that that's changed in 200 years. At the end of the day, do we want the armed agents of the state killing people? And you and I both know that no police officer goes to work and gets in the radio car at the beginning of a shift and says, boy, I hope I can kill somebody today. Nobody does that. But we have to build systems and make our training sort of move in a different direction. I'll close with this part or throw this part out. One of the things that I think we really need to take a look at besides all is the nature of our training academies and how we do that. And I think the European model that is a much longer time and alternates between the classroom and the field over an extended period of time, I really think that we need to look at something like that.
I agree with you, and having spent time in Ireland and watching it up close and personal, I think somewhere in the middle to what we do, first of all, I don't think there are standards that are sufficient enough for the United States because each state can be different. You've got 30 weeks, somebody's got 14 weeks. How the hell can you send a police officer out? What are they missing in those missing 16 weeks? But what I do like about in Ireland, and certainly it's a spinoff of the UK, is the reflective piece where you have to sit back and think about, all right, you learned it, now you applied it. It's really problem-based and applied learning. And we don't do that. We don't sit down and do after action reviews about, so what happened? What did you do? do? What could we have done better? What did you know? What did you want to know? What would you have wanted to know when you got on that call that might have changed your perspective when you landed there? I know that you do that as a boss. I don't think a lot of the sergeants are doing that right now unless we drive it through the organization.
Yeah, and I think one of the two things about that, one is I think that reflective piece is important for a couple of reasons. And one is the academy model currently constructed in the U.S. is generally high stress. I'm actually a proponent of stress academies, at least initially, because I think they serve an incredibly valuable purpose. But if you think about a lot of the nuanced training, like how do you communicate with the mentally ill, or how do you understand cultural differences in different communities? Those are really subtle, nuanced things. And the way our academy is designed, it's a survival exercise. You're going to get through this block of instruction and you're going to pass. So you can now move on to this block of instruction because you're just trying to get out. We need to, I think, change that a little bit. And the other thing is that too often, I think after actions on calls are very often, they become the biggest mistake that we can make is to say that because it came out all right, which it usually does, because it came out all right, we must have done it. And SWAT teams are pretty good about not doing that, about saying, no, here's a mistake. But I don't know that on patrol, as a matter of daily practice, I don't know that we do that.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. I think that's where we can pick up on some new ideas. And we have to be honest with ourselves. You know, we're running way over, but there's a few things that I want to... No, and I appreciate it because it's so important. There's so many things that I want to pick at with you. It seems to me this, that when we were talking about the things that we want to change, that, you know, where we want to take policing, how we want to earn back trust. We have to celebrate what we want to see more of in some ways. And so, you know, I wonder how you do that. So let me ask you to put on your thinking cap. How long do you expect to be serving in this position at the longest?
I think the longest would be really the end of the calendar year. But
okay.
my hope and my expectation is that the city will hire a permanent chief in early to mid-September.
Okay. So you've got several months ahead of you. And I guess the question would be whether it would be Santa Barbara or some other police agency that you went into, what are three things that you are trying to accomplish to leave behind for the benefit of the incoming chief?
One is to provide an assessment of the department, and not just in terms of the usual, you know, what are its strengths, what are its challenges, fairly easy, but really an assessment of the culture. Because ultimately, the chief has to, if they don't do anything else, they're going to change the culture of the agency. They're going to shape it. And they need to have an understanding of where it is. Secondly, is instill in the organization itself to take the existing mission that they have and refine it or reinforce it. And so that there's this sense of mission and purpose that permeates the place so that the new chief inherits that. And third, this is really speaking just on the matter of being interim, making it clear that I'm the chief as of the day that I walked in, and I will be the chief until the day that I walk out. But I don't try to hide the fact that at some point I'm going to walk out and a new person is going to come in. And that person deserves every ounce of effort that I've been shown and that they deserve. This business of, it kind of goes back to our very early conversation, sort of we've lost an appreciation for the importance of position and institution. Mm-hmm. So I really try to drive those things home. And then the last thing I would say to the new chief, when they come in here, besides all that, I remember when I went to work for the sheriff's office, the sheriff read my bio to the command staff, which I really wish he had done, but he did it anyway. And I told him, I said, you know, this document is a statement of what I have done. You will decide for yourself whether what I do is of any value to you. And because I think too often we walk in and too many leaders walk in and say, this is my resume. I keep forgetting where I'm radio. I was holding up.
That's okay. I see it. That's fine. Yes.
Well, this is who I am. But no, it's not. This is who you were. And who you are, you're about to start writing in that book. Mm-hmm. Who you are.
Yeah. Judge me for the way I treat you. Judge me for the way I help you as opposed to what I was before. I appreciate that. What's on your to-do list, your personal to-do list?
Well, I'm going to take Mrs. Malecki on a road trip around the United States. We've been talking about doing that for several years.
Yes.
We have to do that.
Good.
I would like to continue to teach and to be involved in working with agencies and particularly with their leaders to help them be better. I keep telling myself I would like to write a book. You know, I think think I have one in me, but I also know that I heard a very famous Southern woman writer a number of years ago. Somebody asked her what was the key to her success, and she said, "Writers write." And if she's right about that, then other than maybe my dissertation and some articles, I haven't written. So I actually have to start writing if I'm going to be serious about that.
Well, the book, The Profession, is already taken, so you'll have to come up with a new. You'll have to come up with a new one. Last question, Barney, and I have yet to say that we've been talking with Barney Malekian, the chief now of the Santa Barbara Police Department, and I want to know if you had a chance to talk with someone famous, either dead or alive, who would it be? Whose brain would you like to pick?
You know, I have a number of heroes in this business currently, and I could list them off: Bill Bratton, Chuck Ramsey, Ed Flynn, some great people. But I think that I would really have liked to sit down and talk with Abraham Lincoln. Mm. I think when I read his, I've read at least 10 biographies, different biographies of him, and the things that he went through and the times that he lived in, extraordinary nuance of his character and the way he bore up under enormous pressure and enormous criticism. I've read some of the newspaper articles about how he was described at the time. I mean, he's an American icon now, but he was despised by a large percentage of the population at the time. And I would love to spend time with him.
Yeah, he had a counter view that actually won out.
Yeah,
so exactly. And that speaks to sort of the divide, the political divide that we have in this country now. Listen, I want to thank you for your time. It has been a pleasure exploring the things that are in your mind and that you're trying to do. What's up for your weekend? Are you even thinking about it yet?
No, I am, actually. I have two grandchildren down in Texas, 4 and 7. So they will focus my reality.
They'll keep you busy for sure. Well, Barney Malekian, thank you very much for being here. This is the Cop Doc Podcast. I'm Steve Morielli from Boston. We've been talking to Chief Malekian, beautiful Santa Barbara, California. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it. And everybody, please stay tuned for the next episode. Barney, you have the last word.
Steve, thank you for the opportunity. And for those of you in the audience, remember, if you're in policing, that you make an extraordinary difference in the lives of everybody that you come in contact with. And if you're not in policing, remember that those are human beings wearing that uniform.
Very well said. Thank you very much, Barney.
Take good care, Steve.
Thanks for listening to the Cop Doc Podcast with Dr. Steve Morielli. Steve is a retired law enforcement practitioner and manager turned academic and scholar from Western State University. Please tune into the Cop Doc Podcast for regular episodes of interviews with thought leaders in policing.
Hey, everybody, a few things before you leave. First, thanks for listening. I'm so gratified to see the downloads rising in the last few months, not only from the U.S., but from across the globe. It's surprising and humbling to find students, colleagues, and practitioners listening. We have a growing number of listeners in Canada, Ireland, England, Northern Ireland, Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Germany, and Colombia. We appreciate your time and energy and welcome feedback. Please feel free to reach out to me by email at copdoc.podcast@gmail.com. That's copdoc.podcast@gmail.com.